from 90.5 WESA, this is The Confluence. I'm Kevin Gavin. Pittsburgh's annual P4 conference was held this week with a special focus on people.
With people being forgotten, with neighborhoods being neglected, that when the city begins to come back, the first people to get pushed out are the ones who've needed what's coming the most.
Racial equity at the forefront of urban redevelopment. About 5,000 faculty members struck for 3 days against the state-owned universities affecting 100,000 students.
We feel devalued at this point. I think certainly we feel that public higher education in Pennsylvania is devalued.
We'll discuss that and new efforts to make policing more transparent in Pittsburgh to improve community relations. That's ahead on our weekly news roundup. It's The Confluence, where the news comes together. It's The Confluence, where the news comes together on 90.5 WESA. I'm Kevin Gavin. A city report shows the frequency of use of force by Pittsburgh police is on the decline. Meanwhile, the Peduto administration joins a White House initiative for greater transparency in policing. Also, faculty members are picketing at 14 state-owned universities. That's all coming up, but first, the second P4 conference was held this week in Pittsburgh. The P's stand for People, Place, Planet, and Performance. Eric Holmberg is a reporter for Public Source. Welcome, Eric. Good to have you here.
Thank you for having me.
And also covering the P4 conference, reporter WESA reporter Liz Reed. Welcome, Liz.
Thanks for inviting me down to the first floor, Kevin.
Okay. Now, if you have a question or a comment, you can tweet us at WESA Confluence. So about 600 people attended. Is that right? Who are these people? Who was there?
Well, so there were, about 500-600 people. These are, this is an invitation-only conference.
Okay.
So you have politicians, top nonprofit professionals, other community leaders. So it's sort of a group of what we might consider newsmakers, elite people in Pittsburgh who are in places of power.
I think there was also, I saw some activists, people I've seen at protests there. Pittsburgh United was represented, and probably some other protest people that organize protests and activist groups like that.
So did they just crash it or they were welcome?
I assume they were invited.
Okay. And these, were there planners and policymakers as well, I guess? Or because we are talking about, a lot of talk was about development.
Yeah. And again, there was about 600 people there. So it's hard to get a grasp on who everybody is. I don't want to give proportions of, how many people were in government, how many people were in development. But it was definitely a mix of people. And then especially on the panel, as far as the speakers, there was a mix of people. There were artists, there were activists, there were, policymakers as well.
And Eric, there were it wasn't just all local people, were there?
There were some folks from, different organizations, but mainly, this year is actually, a lot of local folks. Last year, a lot of national experts came in.
Right.
So the panel that, I went to on equitable development, a lot of local folks.
Right. So that brings me to my question. I covered the first P4 conference, and it did seem to be sort of a broader focus on all four P's that I mentioned just a moment ago. And this year it seemed to be a much narrower focus.
Yeah, the central theme for this year was equitable development, this sort of idea that as Pittsburgh grows and prospers, everybody needs to sort of share in that success. And so the focus is certainly on new development. How does Pittsburgh sort of integrate affordable housing in a way that lifts sort of all boats? And I don't know if we figured that out yet, but it was a good conversation to have.
And I would say I was there for the very beginning of the conference, which began with a speech from Andre Hines, who's, obviously family has done very well in Pittsburgh and has benefited from a lot of the things that have happened in Pittsburgh. And he showed a old video. It was like he didn't quite cite like what it was from. But it was a documentary style video talking about, this must have been from like the maybe late 40s or early 50s,
okay,
talking about Pittsburgh is doing great things with highways and cutting off the Golden Triangle from the rest of the city, which was a good thing at the time, making it easier for people who moved out to the suburbs to get downtown for work. They were glorifying all these great underground parking garages and all these things that we look at now and we think, gosh, if only we had planned our city a little less for the car and more for the pedestrian, more for public transit, it would be more equitable because, you know, people who have cars tend to have a little bit more money.
Right. And I mean, you see that not only in Pittsburgh, but in, you know, in cities like Dallas, where you have these highways that sort of bisect, separate neighborhoods from other neighborhoods. And that's been a real change in, you know, in the urban design experts that I've talked to, is, you know, reestablishing those connections, especially, you know, focused on pedestrians.
Yeah. I mean, Mayor Peduto did say, literally, we want to put the pieces back together, sort of using this metaphor. It might not even be a metaphor. Literally, there are divisions that they're trying to heal. And so I think Andre Hines showed that video. And then he said, you know, this is a good example of why we shouldn't be too distracted by the great new whizding was the word that he used, but about new technology, that we have to think about development and about urban planning in a way that is applicable regardless of technological advancements. Because when you plan a city for the car, there is a lifetime for that planning, how long that planning is going to be functional. So they want to figure out a way to plan and develop that is going to be more malleable. And that
an evolving process.
Exactly. And that can accommodate changes in technology and changes in how people live.
So, of course, Andre Hines, the chair of the Hines Endowments, and I believe great-great-grandson of the founder of the company. So with the focus on equitable urban redevelopment, how much did the issue of gentrification come up during this?
I mean, it's certainly the backdrop to everything that was talked about at the conference. They mentioned, you know, a lot of that equitable development, the sort of what we're seeing right now is happening in places like the Hill District. In places like the border of East Liberty, Larimer, you have the foundation community investing heavily in a new community or new part of the neighborhood in Hazelwood. So you have development happening in all these places where it's not very attractive right now. You know, not a lot of talk about how we integrate this into East Liberty. How do we integrate affordable housing into Lawrenceville? That's a much tougher question. And I think that what I sort of gleaned from some interviews that I did this week is that we're trying to answer the easy question right now. How do we design affordable housing and equitable development in places where it's not attractive, but where the market forces haven't taken over yet?
Of course, the Hazelwood development, the Almano project.
Right. That's right.
Okay. Eric Holmberg is a reporter for Public Source, and Liz Reed is the WESA reporter. We're talking about the P4 conference this week in Pittsburgh. Angela Glover-Blackwell was one of the speakers. She's president and CEO of PolicyLink. She said that when the city begins to come back, the first people to get sort of pushed out are the ones who have needed what's coming the most.
If we're going to lead with equity, if we're going to focus on equity, if we want to achieve full inclusion, we've got to raise the bar and make sure that we're bringing the equity agenda when development happens. We don't just let the development happen, hoping that it'll trickle down.
And so to me, what I heard East Liberty. It's like I saw East Liberty flashing in bright lights when she was making these comments because, you know, to be fair, I wasn't here when East Liberty's transition right. began. But from what I gather, there wasn't an overall plan that was guided by the city with an eye to equity. And now you look at one of the last affordable housing developments in East Liberty is becoming a Whole Foods. And whether that's a cause and effect, symbolically, it means a lot. You know, Whole Foods is held up as sort of a anchor gentrifier of neighborhoods. And so I think what I was really struck by was that people were not afraid to talk about the mistakes of the past. The panel that I saw was all African Americans speaking very frankly about how people in working class and African American communities and communities of color in general have been affected by gentrification in Pittsburgh.
Well, and when you talk about planning is sort of an interesting topic for me because you have these plans and sometimes they just sit on a shelf somewhere and nobody looks at them. Nobody knows what the plan is. And so you can have a plan for East Liberty all you want, but you really have to have the leverage and the sort of fortitude to say, if a developer wants to come in, they have to follow this plan and they have to follow what the community wants. Sometimes that doesn't happen. And so some of the people that I talked to this week said, well, Pittsburgh was just trying to come back and we were desperate for anyone, any type of development to come in. And so the city doesn't have the leverage to enforce, you know, minimum standards for affordable housing. But they said that that's starting to change. We're sort of at the cusp of where Pittsburgh is becoming such an attractive place for companies and for millennials that we can start enforcing some of those guidelines and, you know, really starting to change how the city looks.
So we accepted the bad or the foreseeable bad or the potential bad just to get the good?
I mean, I think what we have to remember, I mean, I can't answer that question yes or no, but I think what we have to remember is in the time that this was going on, that real people's lives were affected. Real people were pushed out of affordable housing. And, you know, I don't have an example, but I'm sure there's people out there whose lives were devastated because they couldn't live in the neighborhood that they've lived in. And so while the city may be in a place where it can bargain, it does have a little more leverage. I think the even more challenging question beyond leading with equity is how do you right some of the wrongs of the past?
So Liz, I think, mentioned that wasn't afraid to acknowledge the mistakes of the past.
Well, and very blatantly, yeah. Institutionalized racism. Right. I mean, that was the conversation that I saw.
Okay. So Mayor Peduto, though, while what I heard was certainly not trying to run from that, but he was also looking, I guess, more positive, taking the here is an opportunity for the future to be different from the past. That's what I heard.
Yeah, and you know, the P4 conference has that's great. The P4 conference has a lot of great talk and a lot of great sort of you know, issues that are being brought up. But what is the mayor prepared to do? What is the city prepared to do to actually enforce some of these you know, guidelines that we, you know, should be abiding by to have a better city?
He did say I didn't see a lot of specifics, but he did say he wants to codify, to make them law, to, I guess, identify principles to guide equitable development and then make those part of city code so that going into the future. And again, this goes back to creating a system that is flexible enough to evolve as the city and technology evolves.
And that's one of the things that came out of last year's conference were these P4 metrics, 12 categories that the mayor hopes will be implemented by the URA, the Urban Redevelopment Authority, and potentially by city council codified into the city code. And it would sort of score developments, new developments based on a variety of factors, you know, including affordable housing, a sort of private investment, and that process is going to be transparent. He said that we would get to see these scores and know that sort of Pittsburgh's favored sons in the contracting and development world weren't getting bids, weren't getting projects that they really shouldn't be getting when there are other more worthy projects out there.
When either of you were there any ideas, successes, failures, in other words, don't repeat our failure from elsewhere around the country that were shared?
Not that was part of the sort of equitable development panel that I saw.
Okay. So John Wallace, one of the speakers as well, he's a professor of social work at Pitt. He provided attendees at the conference sort of a detailed presentation, a bunch of sobering statistics about disparities between Pittsburgh's white and black residents, as well as in development opportunities. Plus, he was talking about a brain drain among college-educated African-Americans.
We are the studyingest, report-makingest, plan-buildingest people in the world. Can we implement something?
All right, you heard the applause there, and this goes back to something, Eric, that you brought back, that a lot of studies often wind up on the shelf, and that's where they stay. So what's the impetus that this is not just another conference, a bunch of discussions of very good, legitimate points that actually go somewhere?
When I talked to someone recently, did a story on Stanton Heights, one of the most diverse sort of successful neighborhoods here in the city, And some of the residents talked about, you know, in the early 90s, you know, their African-American children would get stopped by the police sort of in a harassing nature just for sort of walking down the sidewalk in that neighborhood. And, you know, they relayed concerns that, well, there was a lawyer down the street and he just decided to move his African-American family to Fox Chapel to just sort of avoid that sort of type of discrimination that the speaker was talking about this week. I think that there are probably other personal examples of that. And, you know, it's something that the city, the police department have to address and figure out because, you know, we need those people. If the city is going to revitalize you know, be this sort of new professional tech-based community, we need everyone. You know, we need, you know, the black professionals, white professionals. We need everyone to sort of be involved in that success.
Well, and I think, you know, going back to the city sort of leveraging this sort of cool, chic sort of reputation that Pittsburgh has right now, and also being a place where there's economic opportunity, whether you are looking for a job or whether you're looking for land to develop. So I think that the city of Pittsburgh, and it sounds like they're going to from what I saw at the conference, but they really do have to leverage that to create equitable development to make sure that, you know, the rising tide does lift all boats.
And there is, I talked to Derek Tillman, who is the president of Bridging the Gap Development. He has a 36-unit affordable housing development that's going to be going into the Lower Hill. And, you know, that's sort of the example of what we're talking about here. He's going to be providing financial literacy courses, setting his residents up with employers. You know, it's not just a place to live. There are all these other types of social services that if they're included in a development like that, it may work out a lot better for the residents.
And I think that also something that's just sort of grasping the greater consciousness in terms of just American culture is we're understanding, you know, we separated neighborhoods from the businesses that they patronize in a lot of places. And we're starting to understand again that people want to be able to walk to the dry cleaners. They want to be able to walk to, you know, a bar to get a drink. They want to be able to walk to the grocery store. And so setting aside whether that's equitable, that's what people want. And that also happens to be equitable because, say, you don't have to have a car in order to have access to fresh, healthy food if you have that grocery store in your neighborhood. And then the other point that I want to make is that I was struck by, I have never seen so many white people in a room acknowledging institutionalized racism. And to me, that was like a really big turning point. You know, I know Pittsburgh is a Democratic city with a big D. It's very progressive. But I think some of those conversations are really difficult and uncomfortable for people to have. And but the only way to move past that discomfort is to have those conversations. So I was very pleased to see those conversations happening.
Well, that obviously stood out for you, Liz, in our remaining 30 seconds or so. Eric, what else stood out to you about the P4 conference?
I think the questions that it raises for the city going forward, you know, these are not easy topics to solve. You know, affordable housing, how do we integrate the ideal affordable housing? So getting that into places that are already successful. You know, we can sort of talk about, well, this is happening in the Hill District, it's happening in Larimer, but where are those opportunities for people to have, you know, a nice place to live, a place that has accessible to public transportation in communities that are already successful.
And quality schools, too. I mean, I think that's going to be a key to development because students have to have quality schools. So the school district, I didn't see discussions about that, but the school district is going to have to participate in this as well.
Liz Reed is a reporter for WESA. Eric Holmberg is a reporter for Public Source. Thanks to both of you.
Thank you.
A new report shows use of force by Pittsburgh police has declined. This while the city has joined a White House-led police data initiative to increase transparency and accountability. That's coming up on The Confluence, where the news comes together on 90.5 WESA. It's The Confluence, where the news comes together on 90.5 WESA. I'm Kevin Gavin. A proposed expansion of ShotSpotter, the gunshot detection system. Pittsburgh joining the White House-driven police data initiative. And a new report on the use of force by city police officers. We're going to talk about all those developments in Pittsburgh policing with Jeff Benzing, reporter for Public Source, focusing on criminal justice and public safety. Welcome, Jeff.
Thanks for having me.
And Christian Morrow is a reporter for the New Pittsburgh Courier. Welcome, Chris.
Thanks for having me.
If you have a question or a comment, you can tweet us at WESA Confluence. So several days ago, Police Chief McClay released a report on the use of force by his officers. And in that, McClay admitted that his analysis was limited to the use of force reports that were filed by officers. So that might, quote, understate the frequency with which force is being used. So with that admission that is based on the reports that the officers themselves submit, how useful is this analysis, this support? Jeff, we'll start with you.
It's an extremely good question. I mean, there's obviously could be either a small difference or a huge difference, right, between what officers are filing in their paperwork and what you would actually see if you're a citizen experiencing one of these events, right? If you're encountering an officer and maybe you think you got treated a little rough, but it doesn't rise to what they would think is, okay, I better file this away. It's not going to appear there.
File this or file this away.
Right. I mean, we're sort of limited to analyze data for which data exists, right?
Chris?
Well, I mean, yes, but of course you would have the option in that case of going to see Beth Pittenger or somebody like that.
From the Police Review Board.
Exactly, yeah. And filing a complaint that way and at least maybe finding out, you know, if anything was done along those lines. But the curious thing about that violence report that I noticed was Chief McClay said that only 1% of the time did they have to use firearms or, the ultimate deterrent. But nowhere in there does it say what those 1% of the cases were. Mm-hmm. And so while it has all this wonderful data about bias against black subjects being more than would statistically be accounted for, it doesn't say how many of those terminal cases, if you will, were involved black suspects.
Yeah, I had that same thought. I mean, you get this report that is supposed to be the, you know, most in-depth that we've seen from the city, and it sort of scratches the surface, right? It's a starting point for more questions, basically, is how I viewed it. You want to be able to say, what happened in these individual incidents? You know, was this something that was justified? Was it something that they have said is justified, but it's really a judgment call? And what you get is a number. And as far as deadly force, I did a word search for it just so I could sort of jump there. And it barely appears, really. It's mostly looking at things like use of tasers and what they would consider like just a rough arrest is mostly what it focused on.
Right. I remember, of course, from 97 to I believe it was 2002, the city was under a federal consent decree, and to track each incident in which officer used force. And I remember being at that news conference involving the mayor and the chief of police, and they were quite upset about having to sign that consent decree. Now, I'm going to look at some of the numbers and get your reaction to some of the numbers that were included in this analysis by Chief McClay. Said that 2014-15 use of force incidents averaged about 1,500 per year, and that was less than 1% of all the calls for police assistance help. Yeah, you wanted to jump in there, Chris?
No.
Oh, okay.
Keep going.
All right. And but the high point, according to Chief McClay, was 1,700 use of force incidents, and that was in 2013. He mentioned that the incidents have dropped by 16%, but not as quickly as the number of arrests. Mm-hmm. What does that say? What does that tell us? So we have fewer arrests. The arrests drop faster, but...
But force is used more often
is that what we're seeing from this? And yet overall, the use of force has declined.
Right.
But
right.
It's not declining as fast as the incidents.
Right. So, I mean, that's sort of a situation where you need more information on not just a number in a chart. You need to say, like, is something going, you know, in a good way or a bad way that's happening? What is happening on kind of the individual level? Is there a training issue? Is there, you know, you're not doing as many arrests, so the arrests that you are doing are for more serious crimes, more contentious type incidents. And that's the kind of thing where you know, you would want to see a whole other report that would tell you that sort of information.
Well, there's also the point that there are fewer officers, and they're making more arrests per officer. And that report will tell you that the officers, it did a breakdown of the officers that use force, and it said of these officers, these particular officers have used it more often and are more likely to, because they don't want a situation to get to the point where they get injured. And they're more likely to do it faster than, say, an officer who has never had to do it before.
Yep. So it's is that fact that Chris just brought up unexpected? And in terms of, well, there are certain situations where certain police officers might respond to more of a, quote, violent situation where use of force might come more into play. And those officers are regularly responding to that. And so, therefore, overall, most police officers don't or rarely use force. But there are some officers that you have use force. Quite, I don't want to say quite often, but multiple times.
Right. So the highest number as far as like what zone within the force out of the five zones is zone three, which is where we are right now.
Right.
You walk outside and there's Carson Street, there's lines of bars and nightclubs and that sort of thing. What the report says is, you know, we don't really know why, but if there's a lot of drunk people, disorderly conduct type things, that may be instances where forces are used, although it doesn't really draw a definite conclusion. It sort of says we suppose this could be the case. But as far as some officers being more likely to use force, what I thought was interesting there is 1 to 5 times over that 6-year period was sort of seen as the normal occurrence, how often you would use it. So less than once a year. But 120 officers used force more than 5 times that amount. And that sort of sends up this question, you know, out into the air, like, what is different here? Is that an abnormal thing? Is that something where things are going wrong and force is being used too often? Or is it simply these are the officers that are in the toughest areas or sort of encountering these situations more because they are literally encountering them more?
And the data doesn't
get to that. And so that's kind of, you know, transparency in terms of data is a really good thing. It's only a starting point, though. It has to be the beginning of a conversation and a beginning of a closer look at individual incidents.
Yeah, I want to get to one more thing about this report on the use of force and then move on to a couple other interesting developments. And it goes to something that Chris alluded to. And from this report issued by Cameron McClay, said in Pittsburgh, 34% of use of force incidents resulted in injuries to the suspect between 2010 and 2015. There were 12 cities studied by the University of South Carolina Research Foundation, and the overall average was 39%. So it was below the average. But there was still as Chris alluded to earlier, still a very disproportionate use of force rate against African-American suspects. But it seems to be going down, but still is much higher. Chris?
Yeah, again, it was, as you were pointing out, these numbers really can't tell you anything. It would seem to imply that there's a bias in these cases. But you can't really tell that from just the raw numbers. You would have to peel them out and see what we're looking at here.
Yeah. So that brings us to what the numbers can tell us, what data can tell us, and how far it can go. That brings us to the city of Pittsburgh deciding to take part in the White House-led police data initiative. What's the intent of this? What's the overall intent of this initiative?
Well, if you look big picture, the really, really important part and the reason why this is a good thing is because police departments tend to be kind of closed units. They do their own thing. If some of them are giving out information to the public, that doesn't mean the one next door is doing the same thing. And so you can't compare. With the use of force report, they say, here's how we're doing. We don't know where we stack up. We have no idea. There's these 12 cities that were studied, as you mentioned, but that's sort of the best that exists. If you have every department in the country, or if you have a little over 100, which is where they are now, you can start to say, you know, something weird is going on in Pittsburgh, or Pittsburgh is totally normal. And you need to have kind of that wider view of what policing looks like in the country overall.
Yeah, and also it would aid to uniformity of reporting. As Chief McClay pointed out, not everybody reports things the same way. Aggravated assault may be this, or resistance may be. There are levels of it that are reported differently in different locations. So you don't have an apples to apples comparison. With this initiative, you could at least get the same definitions in play.
And also, is it just a matter that if you have a little more transparency, shine a light on it, that maybe that would lead to reforms or just better police training or what?
Mm-hmm. I mean, you can't begin to change things until you know what the actual reality is, and this is at least a push toward that.
Sure, exactly. Yeah, the more light, the better, definitely.
One of the tools used by Pittsburgh Police is ShotSpotter, the network of those sensitive microphones that pick up the sounds of gunshots and alert police. The goal is to have the police get to the crime scenes more quickly rather than have to wait for a call to 911 and then respond. It's been in operation for a little more than a year and a half, particularly in the East End and particular Homewood, and now the Public Safety Director Hisrick wants to expand the system, possibly North Side, Hill District, Sheridan. First of all, how has it worked so far? Has it worked? Has it been a success? What's your sense?
I mean, from the police perspective, they see it as being something that has been successful. Obviously, they want to expand it. One thing that Chief McClay told me when I was talking about sort of the just the levels of shootings is that ShotSpotter kind of gives cover to the community. So the fact that it exists means that the police have a way to figure out that something happened, which means if I'm sitting on my porch and I hear gunshots and I call it in, it's not someone is immediately suspecting me of ratting them out for it, right? There's this cover of the technology, which I thought was an interesting point. As far as, you know, there's some issues of how accurate is it? Is it really detecting everything that we need? There's a huge number of gunshots that are just kind of going and we don't know what's going on. But it does give that interesting sort of backing to the community, sort of a backstop.
Yeah, and from a technical standpoint, it seems to be working better than it was initially, you know, thought of, that it would be detecting car backfires all the time and police would be sent on erroneous calls, but that doesn't seem to be happening. The fine-tuning of it seems to be working rather well.
I want to mention that the Public Source just did a story on the rewhitening of the Pittsburgh Police Force. A couple of of course, I believe it was like 75 that federal judge Gerald Weber ordered that new police officers be hired in groups of four, mm-hmm. one white male, one white female, one black male, one African-American female, to diversify in terms of race and gender. And that lasted for a while. So just a quick question to you, Jeff, and that is, where are we in terms of makeup? Do you have any percentage of where we are in the police force right now?
It's we're much worse off in terms of diversity than we were even
after
10 years ago. Right.
Okay.
Right.
All right.
Right. Which is after the consent decree, right? So that went away too. And
well, Tim Stevens, the head of BPEP, Black Political Empowerment Project, said something, was quoted in the Public Source story, that reminded me of something an African-American member of city council way back told me. And that had to do with there's a hesitancy about African-Americans wanting to join the Pittsburgh Police Force because is that almost like a traitor effect?
Sort of, yeah. There is an element of that. But that was always a kind of convenient excuse for contractors and stuff that, oh, we can't find any black people to do this
okay.
job. They're not out there. And there's that element, too. Speaking of consent decrees, they're operating under another one, thanks to the ACLU. and a lawsuit that they won, about a year ago, was it? And where they were found to have been systematically throwing out black applicants for the job. So there are applicants.
Right, and it's also a recruiting issue. And this is something that Mayor Peduto and Chief McClay have said that they're making a big initiative, and it seems like they certainly have that kind of on the top of their mind. But it's not impossible to find qualified applicants who could be police officers who happen to be from the black community. It takes work and it takes outreach. But, I mean, the year that we're in now is 2016. 1975 is when that was identified as an issue.
Right.
I wasn't even alive then. That is that's more than my lifetime that we have not solved this problem. So that sort of lets you know that more needs to be done here.
In our remaining minute, I just want to say something. Okay, so Chief McClay during the summer apologized for the past horrible, unjust history with communities of color. This week, Terrence Cunningham, head of the International Association of Chiefs of Police, apologized for police actions that have led to increased mistrust in the minority community. He got a standing ovation at his conference. So these acknowledgments, are they a start? Are they just words waiting to be followed by actions or what? Go ahead, Chris.
They're helpful in that it's nice to acknowledge, you know, that, oh, we've been real bad about this for a long time. But again, yeah, exactly. What are we going to do about it now? And what can we do about it now? Chief McClay laments the fact that there are certain recruiting things he'd love to do that he cannot do because it's ultimately a civil service decision and it's out of his hands.
And the question there is, does that change your disparity in use of force? Does it change the disparity in arrests and who is being locked up? What do you do with that information? Do you use that to have more policing that's more fair and a more fair justice system and all? Or do you look back and say, we feel bad about it, we're sorry, this is what we have, we're going to... Not sure where we go from here. You got to change or not change.
Jeff Benzing is a reporter for Public Source, focusing on criminal justice and public safety. Christian Morrow is a reporter for the New Pittsburgh Courier. Thanks to both of you, gentlemen.
Thank you.
About 5,000 faculty members are on strike, affecting some 100,000 students at Pennsylvania State-owned University. That's next on The Confluence, where the news comes together on 90.5 WESA. It's The Confluence, where the news comes together. I'm Kevin Gavin. A strike by faculty members against the state system of higher education has ended after 3 days. Officials of the Association of the Pennsylvania State College and University Faculties announced a tentative agreement late Friday afternoon. Joining us now from Harrisburg is WESA reporter Katie Meyer, who covers state government for all the public radio stations in the Commonwealth. Welcome, Katie.
Hi, thanks for having me.
Katie, let's start with some background. About how many faculty members are we talking about?
Thousands, including coaches. I think it's 5,500 in total.
And about how many students do they serve? 100,000 or so?
100,000, yeah, that's the number they usually give, a little bit more than 100,000.
Okay. The faculty have been working without a contract for quite some time, correct?
Yeah, over a year. I think it was June of 2015 the contract expired, and they did not renew it then. And negotiations to figure out a new contract have been going on for, I think, about an additional year before that. So this has been a very long, drawn-out process.
Either in your talks and phone calls with the two sides or your visit to Millersville State University campus, did you get any sense of why the union picked mid-semester to strike? Was it they thought maybe they'd have more leverage in midterm or what?
Yeah, well, I think there's a couple reasons. I don't think anybody really wanted to strike. This was, you know, obviously, it capped a very long period of negotiations. It wasn't a random decision. They had said early this summer, I reported on them sort of mulling over a strike, and then about a month ago, they set a date. And again, negotiations had been going in sort of spurts ever since, you know, throughout this entire process. And I do think that mid-semester, it gave them some leverage, but I spoke with Ken Marshall, who is a spokesperson for the school system, and I asked him, you know, like, did this strike expedite your decision at all? Mm-hmm. And he said, no, we were always committed to getting it done quickly. And Ken Mash says, yes, of course, this made it go quicker when we were on strike. So, and Ken Mash is the union president. So different sides say different things, but I think definitely the strike may have lit a fire under the negotiations to some extent.
Did we even know that negotiations were being held? I remember talking with you, or actually an exchange of emails with you earlier today, and you indicated that there were talks involving maybe union negotiators, but it wasn't even confirmed that the two sides were actually meeting.
Right. So that was very unclear this entire time the strike had been happening. So I know that I've been trying to construct a timeline for this myself. So I know that on Wednesday, they had stopped negotiations on Tuesday night around 9 o'clock. They had given a final offer. The strike happened at 5 a.m. on Wednesday morning. And talks halted then. By evening on Wednesday, both people said there had been no more negotiations. But now, I just spoke with Ken Marshall, again, the spokesman for the school system. He said that talks never really stopped. He said they were always communicating, always going back and forth with proposals. Now, the meetings that were happening today with ABSCUF, they did not involve the school system. The two sides did not meet in person this entire time. And it's a little bit interesting, Ken Marshall saying that talks never did stop, because yesterday, Ken Mash, the president of ABSCUF, lots of Kens in this story, he was out in front of the Dixon University Center, which is the state system headquarters, doing a Facebook Live broadcast and saying that no one had been speaking to him. So if negotiations were happening, at least yesterday afternoon, the ABSCUF president was not part of them. So I have no doubt that talks were continuing, but in what capacity everyone was involved is still unclear.
And I assume that maybe the, quote, secrecy around it was so, you know, we don't publicly say we're negotiating and maybe we can actually get something done a little quicker if we don't have that public eye on us.
I would assume, yes.
So what do we know about the factors that broke the stalemate? The news release from the union mentioned preserving quality education, so they agreed to concessions. What do we know about the factors?
So we know a couple things. First of all, the main concessions that have been made, as far as I can tell, did have to do with their salaries and their benefits, so their health care. The health care plan, again, they aren't releasing details of these things officially until it's confirmed, because right now what we have is a tentative agreement. But of that, I do know that the health care plan that they got was one with higher premiums than they had been paying. Ken Marshall called it a sort of a hybrid plan between the one that most state school system employees get and one that state employees get, so Pennsylvania employees. So what exactly that means, I'm not sure, but I know it involves higher premiums, and that had been on the table the entire time. I think raises are definitely involved. I know they did get higher pay, but again, there had been different rates that were thrown out for adjunct faculty and for full-time or permanent employees. And so I'm not sure, you know, how that all shook out.
We're talking with Katie Meyer in Harrisburg, reporter for WESA and all the public radio stations in the Commonwealth, about the end of the strike by faculty at the 14 state-owned universities. Katie, let's back up to Wednesday morning. You were at Millersville State University, right?
Yep.
And a WESA reporter visited Slippery Rock University out our way. Was there some sort of recurring theme, maybe agreed upon, that faculty members kept talking about their concerns for quality education, rather than they weren't talking so much about numbers and pay and benefits, but concern about quality education we kept hearing?
Right. And I've heard this from the union over and over. And grantedly, in many of the negotiations, some of the sticking points have been things that they said were about quality education. So, for instance, one of the earlier proposals from the state system was to scale back the amount of research that adjunct faculty were doing and instead give them an extra class to teach while still paying them the same amount of money. ABSCUF said that basically, you know, comes out to you paying them less for more work, or the same amount for more work. One of the other things was they had wanted more grad students to teach labs and similar type, not classes, but like practical things in the schools. So these sorts of things, that was what ABSCUF was saying, that really compromises the quality of education.
I see.
Now, a lot of those proposals came off of the table before the strike. And, you know, as compromises go, obviously those are still, you know, they sort of hang over the negotiations. So I think that's generally what was being referred to when people were talking about quality of education. And that did play a big role in the negotiations leading up to the strike. But when it came down to it, those were not on the table.
Okay. So, yeah, I wanted to ask you about some of those, as the union president said in the news release announcing the end of the strike, in exchange for eliminating most of the 249 changes the system proposed in June.
Yeah.
Were there any other key ones?
I'm trying to think. So, we've got adjunct hours. We've got grad school students teaching. They did, there was something about distance education, so like taking online classes. The state had wanted to up that, and they decided not to. Those are the big ones.
Were they all sort of cost-cutting measures?
They were cost-cutting measures, and I think the situation that the state is in all this is sort of in a position where they do have to cut costs. They've had very low levels of funding for several years now, and they've had low enrollment for several years running as well. So there's not a whole lot of fiscal flexibility on the part of the state, which is one of the reasons why these negotiations were so tough.
I have to ask you, what was the attitude of the students that you saw when you were at Millersville State University? Were they supportive of the faculty, or were they just glad to get a couple of days off from classes?
I think it was a little bit of a combination of both. It definitely was, you know, like it's a lot of college students out in the quad with a band. They had, you know, they were all taking part in the protest. So spirits were definitely high, but I did talk to a lot of students and they did seem to sort of categorically support their teachers. And in a lot of ways, and this is what I heard from a lot of them, is that, you know, these teachers are people that they personally know. A lot of them are mentors to these students. And so that puts more of a personal face on it than, you know, siding with the state system of higher education. So they did all seem to be very much supporting their professors.
We have just about a minute left, Katie. The union leaders in their statement thanked Governor Wolf and the leadership of the legislative caucuses, as well as some other members of the House and Senate. Is there any sense that they were directly involved, or was the union just thanking them because the governor and the legislature control the state appropriations for the state-owned universities?
I do think that they were directly involved in some sense. Talking to Ken Marshall with the state system, he said that when I asked him, you know, what Governor Wolf and the Wolf administration's capacity had been, he said they were helping them communicate. So I think maybe helping them formulate negotiations in some way. It did seem like there was some direct involvement, but again, it's not entirely clear what that involvement was.
And quickly, do we have any sense of a time frame for a ratification vote on this tentative agreement?
He said it could take anywhere from a few weeks to a couple of months, so it won't be very soon. But as in the meantime, students are all back in their classes, so the strike is over. The picketers have left the picket line, and I think things are going to be business as usual.
All right, Katie Myers, WESA's reporter covering the state capitol. Katie, thanks so much.
Thank you.
One final note. Following the Al Smith dinner last night in New York, at which both Hillary Clinton and Donald Trump appeared at the same table, separated only by a cardinal, a traditional fundraiser for Catholic charities is this dinner. The two candidates went their separate ways. And where they headed? Pennsylvania. Donald Trump to Johnstown in Philadelphia today. And Clinton will be in Pennsylvania Saturday, both ends of the state. She'll be campaigning with her running mate, Tim Kaine, here in Pittsburgh, as well as in Philadelphia. And for this week, that's The Confluence, where the news comes together on 90.5 WESA. Our engineer is Tom Hurley, production assistance from Vince Bellastrino. The producer of our program, Marcus Charleston. I'm Kevin Gavin. Until next time, hope you have a good week of good news.